Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Welcome to Text Message. I'm Nate Langson.
And I'm Ian Morris.
Let's start with the news. The main news I wanted to start with this week is about BT and EE. And we've talked in the past about BT trying to buy the mobile network EE for just over £12 billion. £12.5 billion, actually. That's quite a little bit over 12.
Yeah. And although it doesn't sound like it in the context of £12 billion.
It doesn't, does it? But it is 500 million quid. And it's been approved by the regulatory bodies that govern such acquisitions for reasons of monopolies and fairness in business and what have you. So BT is going to get control of EE. Now, this is good news for a couple of reasons. For one, on the BT side, it gets to be a quad play provider of media. So that's fixed line, television, mobile telephone and broadband, both regular broadband and also fiber optic. So that makes BT, once again, a big player in the mobile and media spectrum, which is great. On the other hand, EE, there's questions over whether the brand EE, which I think was quite a strong brand and has done very well for itself. And
given how young it is, particularly, you know, it's not been around very long, has it? And it's done good things in that time.
It has done good things, but that's the other good thing that I think about this is that regardless of the name EE, EE became a good name because its product was good.
Yes.
You know, one of the things that it always did, much to the slight annoyance of people on tighter budgets, is that it did provide a good service. And it actually has, for a year or so now, provided the backbone to BT's own mobile network, which is actually a quite compelling deal. If I just go over very briefly, have a quick look at the BT mobile plans now. For £25 a month, and you get £5 off if you've also got BT landline, you get 20 gigabytes of 4G data, unlimited access to BT Wi-Fi, which is quite a lot of spots around the country. You also get unlimited minutes and unlimited texts, plus a couple of bonuses for sign-up. So that is a pretty good deal. The downside, and the only reason why I didn't sign up for this myself, was because you cannot tether. And you still currently cannot tether. So having 20 gigabytes of data is fine if you're going to use all that on your phone. But I tether my iPad Pro and my laptop to my phone a lot. So that's no good. Whereas EE was always very flexible about that, but was more expensive. It did allow you to use lots of devices, didn't hold you back from doing that or using it as a bit of a work connection if you needed to, and offered decent data packages on the top end, but at a premium. So my hope is that by the two brands coming together, maybe we'll get a little bit of the BT affordability blended into the strength of EE's network, which overall I think is great. And, you know, I'm on Vodafone, and I've been a happy customer of Vodafone in the 3 months I've been paying them since I joined Three. But I have to say, I think this is going to be great for me because this is going to increase the pressure on Vodafone to really improve its products, both in terms of speed and price. And I think that's great for all British customers. What say you, Monsieur Morris?
I agree with you. And I don't know, this one excites me because unlike the proposed 302 deal, it doesn't remove one network from play. So, you know, obviously BT was never a huge, you know, mobile player, or hasn't been since it sold, you know, O2 all those years ago. So to have it come back in and own EE doesn't really bother me. I feel like it's such a big commitment that BT must be quite keen on building it up, keeping the strength of that brand. Well, I mean, they'll probably merge it into their own brand, but at least having, you know, it's quite widely accepted and EE wins every speed test on the planet, doesn't it? For, you know, 4G.
It often does, but I have to say, Vodafone, at least in my experience recently, has been performing well. I've had that thing hit 80 megabit down and about 60 meg up.
That's good.
In East London when I'm near the Bloomberg office, which is fantastic, and Three never came close to it. BT is an interesting one because it's had such an interesting history as a network, because originally there was BT Cellnet, And Cellnex launched a mobile network in something like the late 80s or very early 90s on analog and continued for a while. And then I think it was bought by Telefonica.
They made this new company called MMO2. And then MMO2 carried on for a while. It was separate. It was spun off from BT, but it was still, I think, wholly owned. And then they sold it to Telefonica after that. And that's where the O2 brand then, you know, I mean, it was called O2 at the time, but the company name was MMO2, and it was stupid. But that sale is widely considered, and was at the time, to be one of the biggest mistakes BT's ever made. It was not a popular decision, even back then. They were just trying to shed non-related costs, but it was profitable. And I mean, you know, to be fair, they sold it for quite a lot of money. So I doubt they've really lost a huge amount in all this coming and going. But also odd that they went and bought EE, given that O2 is also on the market. And I would have thought a simpler buy for them, because O2 is just a mobile network. EE has all this pretension of being a broadband company and a TV company and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And that will probably end, honestly. I think so, because I just don't see why BT would want to compromise its own... It's got its own very sort of well-established broadband product, hasn't it?
It has.
You know, and TV goes along with that. It has that... I can't remember what it's called. Is it still BT Vision, or is it something else? BT...
There is BT Vision still.
So, you know, that is a much more mature setup, I think, and obviously delivers quite a lot of pay content. So I think EETV probably won't be anywhere near as profitable and will go away.
I think they'll probably just merge them together and brand them. I mean, there's a huge amount of crossover, I think, in those things. But it is interesting, because now you've got BT Mobile that is competing with O2, which used to be BT Cellnet. And I just like the history there that you've sort of... It's almost like Miliband brothers sort of growing up and ultimately competing with each other for the top table. But I mean, BT Cellnet, I think they were the first to have a data network in the UK if not Europe or even worldwide,
I think. Cellnet was bought by BT. So, I had Cellnet as my first mobile carrier back in God knows when. And so obviously I saw a whole load of change before I eventually gave up on it. But yeah, it was good times.
So what does this mean, we think, for people on either network? Well, I think for the time being, very little is going to change, pardon me. One of the things that has been at least semi-confirmed by the CEO of BT, Gavin Patterson, he has said that EE is not immediately going to die as a brand. They do plan on continuing it for some time. And what I think is not going to happen, or at least I would be surprised if it did, is what happened when EE bought Orange and T-Mobile, because the Orange and T-Mobile brands continued as 3G brands and 3G networks, each with their own sort of take on the market, while EE continued as the kind of the big daddy, the big 4G network. Now, I don't think it serves BT well to have both BT Mobile that serves a network that is based on the back of EE, as well as EE, the network. It strikes me that they have at some point got to merge, because it's just too confusing otherwise. Yeah. But I don't think it will affect anyone in a negative way who's currently on a contract, because at the worst case scenario is you'll have an option to leave if they significantly change your tariff and you tell them you're unhappy in time, or B, you'll just get the benefit of these two networks merging and get either a lower price or better data speeds, or, you know, good Lord, maybe BT Mobile customers will begin to tether. Perish the thought, I know. But either way, I think this is great. And it's, you know, we've now got, let's just pretend EE goes away. You will have BT as a massive quad play 4G network. You'll have Virgin Mobile as a quad play network, albeit I think Virgin's based on the back of... Is Virgin on the back of EE? Or are they three? Maybe O2.
So
they're based on the back of another network. And then, obviously, you've got Orange and T-Mobile as 3G networks, and three, of course, and Vodafone and O2. So still huge competition, and at a very exciting time for Europe, because we're moving towards this single market economy where we're going to get rid of mobile roaming across Europe. So I think a number of excellent reasons to be excited about this. I can't think of a major downside.
Well, actually, there is an ongoing discussion with BT about Openreach, which is the infrastructure. And that's quite interesting, because obviously they're quite keen that BT doesn't have too much power. And OpenReach charges everybody, and it's widely hated because people see it as a way of BT making extra money. Personally, I don't see the argument. I think, you know, someone's got to own it, and I suppose they would spin it off and into its own company, but I suspect that would end up making things more expensive.
Podcast at natelangson.com. That is the inbox to which you can sling your thoughts and feelings on the back of your finest carrier pigeon. Ian, it's that time again. We have to talk very briefly about an Apple rumor, simply because you and I are intrigued by said rumors. This one is not particularly surprising, but there is a strong rumor that a new iPad Air, tentatively titled iPad Air 3, is due to be released, or at least announced, in March, along with the iPhone 5 SE that we talked about, I think, last week, and some new Apple Watch models, although I can't imagine we're going to see a radical redesign yet of the Apple Watch. But the iPad Air 3, now this is an interesting one, because you and I were talking just before we started recording the podcast this week that we have both quite happily migrated to using iPad Pros and leaving the iPad Air 2s somewhat in the dust. Now, I didn't for a long time. I had a review unit, a loaner from Apple, and had it for a while and never even used it, because I just carried on using the iPad Air 2 because that was the one that I liked. It's the one that I had bought by my work, and it just seemed like the most obvious thing to use and abuse. But recently, I decided to give the iPad Air Pro another go, and I have to say, since I've started using it again, I've found that I very rarely use a laptop at all, and I keep finding myself coming back to just the quality of the screen and how close it is to the front of the glass. And it makes a huge difference when you're reading. And it's just something that I think, combined with the fact that a lot more apps now have split screen support, so you can run two apps side by side, it's just really calling into question what I need from a day-to-day computing device, even for work and for home, that the iPad Pro doesn't already offer. However, if they can cram the resolution of the iPad Pro, the four speakers, you know, the two on either side, and maybe the battery life and the processor into the iPad Air 3, I'm going to be extremely confused as to which device I need to plump for as my actual device, because the screen was really the real reason I wanted to move to the Pro, but I stayed for the split screen support. But if I can get all of that in a smaller body, I actually think that could be quite exciting, and that's certainly what the rumors pertain to. That's what the rumours seem to suggest is going to come.
There's also been some talk about support for the pencil. I said pen, but I meant pencil as well. And now, does that potentially mean that Apple's going to make the Air a mini iPad Pro? Now, I know that's slightly confusing, but I think the real draw of the iPad Pro for sort of people who are artistically inclined has been the pencil gives them a lot of flexibility to do stuff that they can't do on a lot of other devices. And if they can sort of bring that and the keyboard, which has really won me over, to the iPad Air, then I think they could be onto a winner.
I think the keyboard is brilliant. I actually don't use it. I bought a different
Interesting.
One. I bought a little Logitech wireless one, because what I found that I preferred was using the iPad at an angle that I didn't also want to type at. For example, I would often sit on the sofa, kind of laying on my left-hand side, and I'd sort of I'd prefer the keyboard to be on my lap while my eyes were pointing slightly left towards the screen.
Right. I do not need to use a laptop now. I know that this isn't for everyone, because I understand that there are a lot of people who do a lot more on their computers and who are very reliant on mice. But actually, if you think about what the mouse does, really, it's just a way of moving around the screen. And you don't need to do that when you have a touch screen.
I think Apple could probably adapt a mouse to work with the iPad quite easily.
I would think so, but that is not a very Apple thing to do, is it?
Well, isn't it?
I don't think so, personally. I mean, a Bluetooth mouse, you could easily pair it. It is literally one change in the software, isn't it, really? You could easily do it, and you could use the Magic Mouse, or you could even use that little trackpad they've got if you really wanted to, if they chose to support it. So
the trackpad as well, I think, though, the key is that the thinking is that you need the software to be designed for touch, which is why shoving full-on Windows on a phone never really worked or never worked. You need to come at it from the other way. You need to design for touch. But once you've designed for touch, what you've basically done is designed for simplicity of interaction. And if you just assume that your mouse is a finger, there's a hell of a lot you could do on an iPad Pro with a mouse without it feeling weird or unusual at all. And honestly, I'm really getting to the point where I think if they did that, there is no need for a laptop anymore, except for heavy lifting. I still edit and produce this podcast and do the web design on it.
Yeah, if you think about it logically, actually, you could easily do that on the... I mean, that's one thing you do need a mouse for. So the iPad Pro and probably all the iPads have more than enough power to do audio editing. They can do video editing to some extent. Yeah. I mean, you're limited somewhat by the fact that you really need to stick to Apple's formats to do it.
And this could be good. Apple recently had its earnings call. iPad sales are about 25% down over this time last year, and it needs to do something this year to really bump up those sales. So whether that's getting cheaper models into schools by creating higher-end top models to kind of balance out the difference in costs, we don't know. Maybe there'll be a cheaper iPad Pro. Can't see that happening before the autumn, if ever, because that kind of defeats the point. But it'll be interesting to watch. Check 9to5Mac. Or iPad Air 3 if you want to have a look at Mark's full write-up. He's got quite a lot of detail in there. Something cropped up on V3 this week that I wanted to point out, which is that Arbor Networks published a security report, which it does annually. It's based on worldwide data from reports from network operators around the world. And it showed that the world record, such as one may possibly consider this a world record, for DDoS attack data rates, bear with me, people, I promise you this is interesting, has been broken, and was broken rather, in 2015. This is the amount of data that criminals, let's call them that for want of a better word, are throwing at networks in order to knock their servers offline. So this is the kind of thing you hear when a massive website or a bank or something is hit by a huge distributed denial of service attack that takes their website, takes their system offline. Companies are putting huge amounts of money into defending against these things by having bigger service centers and more robust protection against these attacks. But obviously, the rise in computing power globally and cheap computing power has meant that more data can be thrown at their servers in order to knock them off. And this week, I saw a number that I'd never really seen before, which is the answer to the question, how much data do you need to throw at a server every second in order to knock it offline? The answer, it turns out, is about 500 gigabits per second.
Wowzers.
So to put that into perspective, that's roughly, and I do mean roughly, about 50 gigabytes being thrown at servers every single second, which is just going to overwhelm the system and force it to crash. And that was the highest. There were a number of these over the 400 gigabits per second mark, and quite a few in the 200 to 300, and obviously hundreds, if not thousands, under the 100 gigabits a second mark. But I just found it really interesting to see some numbers. Like, this is the kind of, these are the kinds of numbers that we're now seeing take these servers offline. 50 gigabytes, gigabits per second. And the expectation is that that's going to double this year. So that's going to push us into the 1 terabit per second of data being thrown at servers to knock them offline. This is significant stuff. It's affected huge numbers of companies in the UK. I think HSBC, I believe this week or last week, was knocked offline as a result of attacks similar to this. Did this number surprise you at all, Ian?
Well, I don't know, really. I mean, I suppose you don't think about the amount of data that's being thrown around, really. I mean, I tend to think of it more as... I sort of assumed that it was more about requests. So more than the data being chucked, I thought it was more about the number of computers that were chucking it. But apparently it is just a simple matter of maths. And if you make enough requests or, you know, put enough data over the pipe, then of course you flood it out for everyone, don't you?
Exactly. And a request is data. I mean, everything that goes into a server is data. It's just bits. Yeah. So it's enough requests and data to total 500 gigabits per second.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess I hadn't really sort of considered the actual number, but this is quite interesting. And it's also interesting, it almost gives you a picture of the internet, doesn't it? To say, well, this, you know, next year it'll be, you'll have to throw double that. And it tells you huge things about what our data centers are handling and how much data we're talking about globally.
Yeah, I mean, put this into context, in 2004, it would have been around 8 gigabits per second at a peak.
Wow.
for a DDoS. In 2010, it was about 100 gigabits per second. So it's increased fivefold since 2010 to 500 gigabits per second. And to put that into context as well, you know, most people's broadband is probably somewhere around the 10 megabits, and we're talking 500 gigabits here. So just an just gigantic amounts of data resulting from computers worldwide pooling their resource together to take even banks like HSBC offline this week. So want to keep an eye on everybody, and you know, next time you see a stressed out sysadmin walking out of a bank looking stressed, maybe give him a crisp, offer him a hug, and say it'll be okay. It'll be okay. Right, Ian, my teeth are of a very strange hue. It's like I've bitten into one of the fantastic drummers in Blue Man Group. I have blue teeth. Ian, we're talking Bluetooth.
Thank goodness. I've been waiting for this for, I don't know, years.
Bluetooth has had an interesting history. About 10 years ago, I think, very roughly, I was reviewing Bluetooth headsets for a website, CNET, in fact, and they were all terrible. Awful, absolutely abysmal. If you were trying to listen to music over Bluetooth, you might as well just do, I mean, basically anything else within the same region of comfortability. You know, dysentery, punching yourself in the nose. It was really a terrible experience, and I've never really recovered from that. To me, Bluetooth has been a very convenient way of transferring files, of connecting keyboards to iPads, and of, you know, using wireless headsets for phone calls and things. I've never, ever, up until about 2 weeks ago, ever considered Bluetooth anything other than a bitter disappointment, named after, I think, a Dutch king whose name was Bluetooth in the 1600s or thereabouts. And then something amazing happened. And what that was I bought my girlfriend Kate a pair of headphones, and I've looked up this pair of headphones to find out which pair they were, and they were BT-ZX750BNs. And there's nothing particularly interesting about those headphones other than they cost about 130 quid, and she really wanted them, and I was pairing them just to see if they were working, and initially I was disappointed by the sound quality. Then I realized that her Spotify was set to just regular streaming. I then put it up to the higher level. And then something very interesting happened. I found myself to be very, very impressed with how good these headphones were. I knew they were pretty good ones because they were reasonably expensive, and but I wasn't prepared for the fact that I genuinely thought, hang about, these sound quite good. Not just these are all right, they'll do for phone calls. Actually quite good. Then I tried them again, and I agreed. Then I went down to Richer Sounds around the corner from my office and tried a couple of other pairs, and they were also equally good. And then I ended up buying a pair of AKGs.
Ah, interesting.
The name slips my mind now. But they were about the same price. They were about £130. And I have now been using these for 2 or 3 weeks. And I adore them. I now look at a pair of cables for headphones when I'm walking. And this is a key difference. I'm not talking about use at home. I'm talking about commutes, walking, cleaning the house, that sort of thing. And I just, you know, I basically, Ian, I want to spit on them. Now, in home scenarios, there is no replacement for a good cable for various reasons. You can connect them to headphone amplifiers. The cables are thicker. The headphones are bigger. The drivers in the headphones are better. Everything about them is generally better. But for commuting, for traveling, for pairing between two or three different devices at one go, I mean, I'm surprised it's taken me this long because they have been a lot better than they used to be for quite some time now. But I was taken aback, frankly, and I wanted to put this on the podcast.
I love the fact that you know, this has just suddenly happened to you. I mean, Bluetooth headphones have been pretty good since Aptx started, really. I mean, I don't make massive use of them, but that's purely because I don't really feel the need to. But like you, I find cables very annoying. They're inconvenient. They get in the way. I've got cabled headphones on now, and I keep catching the cable on my arm. And sooner or later, I'm going to pull the lead out the amp, and then the speakers will start, and then the podcast will sound horrible. So, yeah, I can see the definite advantages. Do you think that this revelation of yours might be something, have a relation to the fact that maybe Apple thinks the same way and that they will be dropping the headphone jack from the iPhone?
Let me tell you why that answer is no. I bought these headphones a couple of days before I saw the rumor about them going headphone cable free originally. Yeah. So it is more than a couple of weeks, I admit. It's probably more like 6 weeks or something. But it's quite some time, let's say a month. You know, we're not going to beat each other up over the course of over a space of a couple of weeks, are we?
No.
What's a month between? What's a couple of weeks between friends?
How long have we known each other in the period of time that we've known each other?
It's a decade.
It's a mere fragment, isn't it?
It is a fragment. But no, I mean that does have a benefit. But there are still many scenarios where you do want cables. The latency I find is better with cabling, and sound quality. If you're using a hi-fi system at home and you've invested in good audio quality, then cabled headphones do make a huge, huge difference. They're not battery powered. There are a number of reasons why they're better. But when you're on the go, one of the things that I had to let go of in my kind of hi-fi obsessed way of being, which is to like higher res audio and buying CDs and all this sort of thing, is that on the go there's a great convenience. And I ditched lossless audio on the go, you know, a couple of years ago, because when you're traveling on the London Underground and you're walking, you're so the audio is already being muddied by the combined sound of people coughing or the trains on the track. And even if you put noise cancelling on, then yes, you're getting rid of that noise, but you're still not getting a pure sound. And there just comes a point where convenience of using things like a streaming cloud service that still has great sound quality, and now combining that with wireless audio, it's changed the game for me. And I just find this whole scenario to be incredibly weird, because like you, I probably should have expected to have done this earlier. But I wanted to sort of throw it out there to people on the podcast and just get other people's views on Bluetooth in general.
Yeah.
You know, are you against Bluetooth? Did you hear Bluetooth around 2006, 2007 and think, this is about as pleasant as listening to a bag of dogs being punched repeatedly?
Bluetooth's one of those things, like, probably the Bluetooth that we have now, it probably bears such little resemblance to the Bluetooth that started it all off. Like, they've probably got nothing in common, really.
Bluetooth now is based on similar standards to Wi-Fi.
Yeah. So, I mean, really, it's not a massive surprise that things have got better. And to be honest, Bluetooth may well go away as things change. It might become the case that we, you know, phones have one radio that does everything. Like, it might be that when 5G comes along, you know, we can have... Because I've spoken to Qualcomm about this, and they've sort of given me the nod and said, yeah, it's possible that Wi-Fi at home could be replaced by 5G on unlicensed spectrum. So you'd move 5G onto the old around the Wi-Fi thing, and then, you know, maybe if it's power efficient enough, then maybe you could use it for peripherals as well, and have some headphones that use it. Who knows? I suspect that the more we can sort of bring all these technologies together, the better we'll be. You know, the more bandwidth they'll be available and stuff like that. So who knows? This is probably just one step before we get something even more amazing and that you can have lossless over.
Indeed. Well, that's the downside here, because although Bluetooth does now have better throughput, it's not going to do lossless over a standard Bluetooth protocol yet. There still needs to be some changes there. I actually looked into the Bluetooth protocol specifications on Apple's developer website just to have a look at how, you know, what kind of quality Apple says that Bluetooth needs to operate at in order to connect to its full Bluetooth hardware. And what it's actually doing is that it's passing through audio at about 256 kilobits.
It's really not very much, is it?
Over AAC. Well, no, it is, in a sense. It's not anywhere close to lossless or Apple, ALAC, Apple Lossless Audio Codec, which would need to be, you know, at least up to sort of 1411 kilobits a second. This is still only 256, but it's AAC, it's 256. That's exactly the same as what Apple streams Apple Music at. So you're getting Apple Music coming down your system at 256K AAC, and then it's just throwing that across Bluetooth, which is also AAC, into your ears. Now, that's great, and that explains, well, it's part of the reason why Bluetooth sounds good, is that you are getting the same audio bitrate on the same codec as you're getting it onto your phone in the first place. So it's great, and it's a start, But I agree, for lossless, we need to go a little bit further. And when that happens, because Apple is highly likely, I'm sure, in the future to release, you know, iTunes Plus again, but call it iTunes Plus with a plus symbol. And it'll be like a lossless, high-res audio format. And they'll have some funky Wi-Fi thing that supports lossless audio wireless protocols. And that will happen down the line. But for now, I'm just genuinely quite impressed with where Bluetooth audio is. And I would welcome people's views on this. And have you had a similar revelation to me about Bluetooth or wireless audio? What are your thoughts? Am I wrong? Have I insulted your knowledge with my own lack thereof? Let us know. podcast@natelangson.com. Ian.
Yes, Nate.
I have nothing else to add on this topic.
Oh, thank goodness for that.
That was a bit of a rant.
It was worth doing. It does make me chuckle. Nate comes to Bluetooth and there's a podcast feature about it.
You know when somebody sort of hovers a bag of pepper under your nostrils and you
yeah, and you yeah,
and
sneeze.
You just sort of feel for a little while like
yes.
like a massive sneeze is building up. And then you
the
do
the best feeling and the worst feeling simultaneously.
Yes. Well, when it goes away. But what I was trying to get across in this example is when somebody's dangling the aforementioned bag of pepper under your nose, and just for a while it's building up and it's building up, but suddenly you just need to burst and you just need to flood the world with your sneezel power, if that is indeed a term, which obviously it isn't. That's what I had to do just then with Bluetooth. So
yes.
Thank you for letting me sneeze in your in your ears.
Oh my God.
I'm deeply
and
appreciative.
There we go. That's it for the podcast. No one is ever going to listen ever again.
See you next week.
Bye.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.